This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions, online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And it's the big after-party celebration. The tour goes on. The president has finished his State of the Union address, and now he's going around stomping from city to city to spread the joy that he began last night. But is it joyful? Was it joyful? Was it exciting? Did anyone walk away from this address going, man, these next few years are going to be awesome? I can't wait. What is he going to, are you kidding me? More money? What? I am so jazzed to have these two people here with me to discuss what was just an incredibly exciting State of the Union address. I had popcorn. I sat up in bed and watched the show, and I know Dr. Neela Richardson did too, and so did Dr. Chris Payne. You guys are here to discuss with me the fun that was the State of the Union. Just a couple. Neela, you're scrunching your nose. What?
You had a lot more fun at this address than I did.
About?
I have to say. I do not share your rock star status with the State of the Union. I thought that it was contained. It was a small visioned.
Yeah.
And I didn't get a lot of big takeaways from it. But not to dismiss your enthusiasm for the actual policies, I just don't share it.
Yeah. No. It was one of those evenings where it was rather tough to stay awake, wasn't it? I mean, let's be honest about it. It was a snooze fest.
Yeah, okay. I may give you that, because I did have a hard time staying awake myself, but I did watch it, and I was excited about a few things. Number one, Speaker John Boehner is incredibly tan. Where is he doing this? I would expect this from the vice president. You know, he's out socializing.
Out and about,
you know, getting the sun. Anyway, the one thing, and I never really paid a whole lot of attention to this. They're looking at each other like, why are we here? What have we walked into? I got a point. Trust me. We'll get there. May take a minute. One of the things that I found incredibly noticeable throughout the entire evening was the incredulousness that the speaker sat there with his arms kind of at his lap and just almost like a vacant stare off into space. Like, am I paying attention? Do I even care about what's going on? And almost as the applause were happening, as he made a few points to the president, that is, and you see the Democrats rise and a few Republicans rise, there's that, I swear I will slap you if you stand up, look on your face. Everybody's seen it.
You know, he's in a tough position because within his party, he has a lot of space between,
sure.
There's been this Republican versus Republican fight on the agenda for most of the second term.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were three parties in the room last night. There were the conservative Tea Parties, there were the moderate Republicans, and then there were the Democrats. And so he had to play to at least two of those.
Yeah.
And it might have been that he was contemplating which one he was going to identify with at that moment for that particular issue.
Or his reaction might just have really shown us that what a pointless speech it was in many respects, and one that really achieved so little in terms of trying to do something this year. And by which I mean, let me explain in a bit of detail about that. We have this, President Obama's now telling us that we're going to have some executive actions where Congress can't move forward. Bang, he's going to do it himself. So what have we got? When you actually look down the list, what have we got? Well, we've got raising the minimum wage to $10.10 for federal contract workers. As far as anyone can work out, there are no federal contract workers currently being paid less than $10.10.
I was scratching my head when I heard that last night going, federal contractors making what?
No, seriously. There are about 15,500 federal workers
at the
minimum wage. Of 3.5 million workers on the minimum wage, $7.25 at the moment, but completely a non-entity in terms of federal contract workers. Then we got a starter savings account to help low-income families save for retirement. Well, they have no savings and they can't save out of the income they have, and the cost of living is too expensive to save. So really, it's just a pointless gesture. We're launching 4 new manufacturing institutes. What on earth does that mean? What is the success record for governments setting up manufacturing institutes? I don't even understand that. And we are connecting 20 million students to better technology at schools. Okay, but the standards of schooling over the last 20 years have not improved, in actual fact, the outcomes, however much technology we put in the classroom. So the executive actions don't actually get us anywhere. All they can possibly do is just irritate Republicans and make them less willing to actually work with the White House or congressional Democrats on anything.
Okay, so those executive actions that we refer to, and I look at him as flexing his muscle now, going, you know what, I don't need you people. I'll do what I want with my pen, and I'll make it happen whether you're on board or not. Does that gain him any more supporters? His approval rating is around 43%. Does that improve his approval rating with everyone else? Do the Democrats now appear as though those that are willing to work with anyone, and makes the Republicans look even worse?
You know, I thought that President Obama would use this moment to kind of gather that support, granted that he has a Congress that has been reluctant to work with him in the past, though it did pass a budget, so there was a chance to feed off that momentum.
Right.
Looks like there's some seeds of agreement on immigration. But that goal, that rallying of the Democratic base was sidestepped a bit. And I think it was a missed opportunity in terms of the overall outlook for the election. Secondly, the bully pulpit is not as effective as it was when he took office in 2008.
Kind of
and
a
there were
up now,
and
know?
There were times when he has used the bully pulpit successfully, and he tried to last night when he said to corporate America, give America a raise. It was a great line, but I would counter, give America a job. There are 10 million people who are still looking for work right now. A lot of them are still unemployed, and we have no movement on this very crucial issue of unemployed benefits extension. So that bully pulpit is not being used as effectively or as forcefully now as it was 5 or 6 years ago.
And my boss is not going to respond to a call from President Obama to give me a raise. Quite simply.
He hasn't in the past, no.
No.
Well, in essence, could that be construed as give people jobs rather than just give them a raise? Give them something rather than nothing.
But there's no jobs policy being talked about. And this is not just Obama's domain. There is no job policy coming out of either party. And yet it's a significant issue. If you want to get Americans excited, you talk about jobs. And that's just not what we focused on last night.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess obviously, my feeling is if you're a Democrat, if you're a grassroots Democrat, you're not really going to be galvanized by that speech. In fact, I think you're going to be thoroughly disappointed that, as Neela says, we haven't addressed jobs. It doesn't really address it. I don't think it really addresses inequality in any particular way. So the grassroots Democrat's going to be disappointed, and grassroots Republicans just going to look and say, this is more of the bully pulpit. We hate this guy, frankly. So what have you gained out of that speech?
Interesting. Does this position those Democrats who are up for midterm elections, does that put them in any better standing at this point?
Well, my argument is that no, because you're not galvanizing your base in any way, and you're not setting out the vision, again, as Neela said at the beginning, that may just bring people over to Democrats. I mean, I think they have to be obviously there's worry about losing the Senate, and
right.
I don't think this speech has made that any less likely.
One thing that the president did do successfully last night is make a joke that people actually laughed at, and not in a cynical way, about healthcare.gov. I mean, it was a very successful joke. I think it even surprised the president how successful it was. Go ahead, register. Kids, get your parents to register for you. And, you know, they'll be happy to hear from you. That was a great joke, a joke probably you couldn't have carried off even 6 months ago. And that tells you how far we've come with the Obamacare website. Now, whether that's going to be a successful rallying cry for Republicans, it remains to be seen. But certainly last night, you know, he was able to deftly mention healthcare.gov and then move on.
He was in and out. He didn't really linger on the point to give anybody an opportunity to give a shrill look to a camera going, this is not going to happen.
Right.
So all in all, do you think the president felt as though it was a success?
I think the president must be wondering how he's going to make his second term a success. And I feeling pretty deflated about the whole outcome. I mean, this goes back to the problem. Once Democrats lost control of Congress, lost control of the House back in the first, you know, those first midterms, it was always going to be very, very difficult for given the fractious nature of the whole Obamacare debate to really follow through with an agenda. And I don't think that's changed.
All roads lead through Congress. If you want to do anything to help income inequality, which is a significant issue and growing, if you want to do anything about tax reform, immigration, it all goes through Congress. To sidestep them so obviously doesn't do any long-term significant policy action.
Flexes some muscle, some presidential muscle.
Not flexing very much muscle. That's the point. What's he doing with his executive actions? Very little.
Right. Right. Very good analysis of what the president actually laid out last night. And as you were defining it, I was actually falling asleep.
Yeah. So.
Let's hope your viewers weren't, Alan.
No need to say any more than that, is there?
And with that, we'll bid you to adieu. I know you have an engagement to get to, so we'll let you go. His name is Dr. Christopher Payne. Her name, Dr. Neela Richardson. Thank you so much for your in-depth analysis of what I thought was a pretty darn exciting State of the Union.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you very much.
Well, the fireworks continued even after the speech was over with Representative Michael Grimm. He's a Republican from New York. He was asked about some campaign contributions. Well, NY1 reporter Michael Scotto attempted to ask him about some campaign contributions.
And just finally, before we let you go, since we have you here, we haven't had a chance to kind of talk about
I'm not speaking about anything that's off topic. This is only about the president.
Well, what about...
Thank you.
All right, so Congressman Michael Grimm does not want to talk about some of the allegations concerning his campaign finances. We wanted to get him on camera on that, but he, as you saw, refused to talk about that. Back to you.
Why? Let me be clear to you. You have to do that to me again.
I just wanted to ask you. Why? This is a valid question.
You're telling me what? No, you're not mayor. You are not mayor. Break you.
I will break you. I will throw you off this balcony. Don't do it again.
Will the fun ever stop?
Government actions
meet business decisions.
Business decisions.
Bloomberg Government, Capital Impact. Let's talk a little bit about the fun that we're having versus the price the environment may be paying a little bit down the road. Came across an article which the title alone struck my fancy, so I knew you would like it. Air travel is worse than a Hummer with wings. Its author, Megan McArdle, is here with me today. Hey, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm staying put this summer, being good for the environment.
So you're taking a page out of Christine Ashwanden's book, basically?
Well, actually, I should confess, we're staying put because we didn't really have time to go on an air travel vacation. I was really intrigued to read this article by Christine Ashwanden, who says she didn't go anywhere by air for a year because she realized just how bad it was for the environment. And so she gave up travel and stayed home and discovered the joys of staycationing rather than going to far-flung locales.
So this is interesting because even as I'm reading the article, and you bring it up a little bit later on in the piece itself, outside of Christine's portion, no one really thinks about what air travel is doing. I mean, we're here in the path of National Airport. I live near BWI. We've got so many rules and regulations around emissions on vehicles. I just took a car in for an emissions test recently. I see planes flying overhead all day long. Every couple of minutes, another one's landing. Really bad.
much worse than driving for most people who are at least like you and me, working right. as urban professionals, living somewhere where you're not commuting an hour and a half every day. Actually, one transcontinental plane flight in an economy seat is the equivalent of driving a mid-sized sedan about 7,500 miles a year.
And we're talking about tons of carbon dioxide being released.
It's not just carbon dioxide, actually. That's part of it. But it's also it's where the emissions happen. So it isn't just the CO2. It's also the water trails, those vapor trails that you see right. when planes go by overhead. It's ozone. And because it's happening high up in the atmosphere, the effect is more powerful than emissions that happen here on the ground.
Super greenhouse effect. What's the big deal?
Well, I don't know about you, but I find Washington already quite hot enough in the summer.
That's a good point.
We don't need any more mosquitoes in our backyard.
Good point. Good point. You know, you don't think about things like that.
Exactly.
You start turning it into a, what is the thing called? I'll be editing this. You turn it into
a giant swamp.
Rainforest. I
mean, yes. We're going to basically turn DC back into a swampy rainforest if we're not careful.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I find interesting is not to have that same old argument about whether global warming is happening and whether we should stop it, but that people who do agree that it's happening and do think that we should do something about it, somehow they take plane travel out of the calculation, right? They talk a lot about having a small car or no car. They live in a smaller house. They like an urban, walkable neighborhood.
They even give you tax credits for buying that hybrid vehicle.
Exactly.
And things like that, making it more appealing.
How many people do you know who own a Prius and then go on European vacations, right?
Probably all of them.
Exactly. And a European vacation is much worse for the environment than the extra emissions that you saved by buying the Prius.
So you made a clear distinction a little while ago, and I wanted to get back to that with regard to a coach seat. Coach seat versus first class. So me buying an extra first class seat just to put my bag on is bad.
Yes, it is worse than just having a coach seat. Basically, if you think of you've got this big plane, it's made of aluminum, it weighs a lot. Neither you nor I could probably lift it with one hand,
sure.
Or even two. And so you have to allocate the weight of that plane per passenger.
Sure.
And so if you're in a coach seat, you get a little bit of the plane. But if you're in a first class seat where you're taking up two and a half times as much space, you have more weight of the plane to move through the sky than you do if you're way back in cattle class.
Cattle class, I like that. So, and I do this all the time. I think about emissions. I won't say I do. I think about emissions all the time, but you're behind that older vehicle. Occasionally you see the older ones out there on the road and go, wow, it's got the historic tags. I'm like, that's great. Wow, that's doing a wonder for the environment. Are they? I mean, you see that old Chevelle SS or the really old Toyota Celica, which kudos for them for still running. But
the old Toyota Celicas, I think that those things ran on like you just sort of, they're like the Flintstones cars, right?
Sure.
You just stick your feet out the bottom and run. But yeah, the old giant gas guzzlers, those beautiful vintage cars that you see
right.
from the 50s, they're beautiful, but they burn a lot of gas. On the other hand, at this point, there are so few of them around
right. That
it hardly seems worth banning them for the added emissions. The real issues are the things that we all do every day. It's going on those long distance trips, and it's driving, you know, a large SUV with us as the only passenger. Those
right.
are the real things.
It's more comfortable that way, though. I'm just
exactly.
saying.
Exactly.
Very
spacious.
You don't hear spacious. Any complaints from the back seat. You got nothing going on. But in comparison to the vehicles, you don't see very many of those really old relic-like vehicles on the road. But the fleet of planes that are flying today are about that age.
And getting bigger.
And older. And getting bigger, exactly.
And those fleets are getting bigger
yeah.
because air travel is getting more and more popular. And it's easy to understand why, right? I mean, who doesn't want to go to exotic Turkey or honeymoon in Thailand?
Right.
But the problem with that is that honeymooning in Thailand is basically as if you guys had each bought a new midsize sedan and driven it around for a year.
Wow.
That's a lot of emissions.
That really puts it into perspective. But I have a feeling that there's not much. I mean, as much as I would like to say something will happen with this, I think there's a business reason behind why people are taking air travel out of the mix.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a sort of personal reason about it. We all like to advocate policies that are lower cost for us, sure. right? And so when I talk about carbon emissions, that's really easy for me. I live in the middle of the District of Columbia. I drive a Mini. I've owned my Mini for 5 years, and I have put about 8,000 miles on it.
Oh my gosh, really?
I wish your viewers could see the look on your face when I said that, right? Well, I grew up in Manhattan, and so even having a car and but you know, for example, my husband grew up in North Florida, and our attitudes towards things are completely different. I view it as kind of shameful to go out and drive and get your groceries if they're small enough to carry. He thinks it's ridiculous to do anything except drive.
I'm kind of on his side here.
Right, yeah. This is everyone, you know, it's absolutely cultural for me. So my car is driven less than most people's, but so advocating greenhouse gas control for me is really low cost, right? It's practically no problem for me at all. But for someone who lives in a rural area, yeah. may have three kids, you got to get car seats for all those kids in there. And then maybe you're hauling brush on the weekends, you know, a giant pickup truck starts to look a lot more attractive. And so I think that what people are doing is they're psychologically taking out this big cost for themselves, because the people who advocate for global warming controls, by and large, are people for whom the part where you have to get a smaller car and drive less is not very costly. But for the part where you think, I would have to give up going to all my conferences and my business trips, and I would never get to vacation in Greece or visit my friends in San Francisco and all of that wonderful sourdough bread sure, and Napa sure. Valley, that starts to seem a lot more costly. And I think that tells you a lot about how the debate over global warming has proceeded in the United States.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest is Megan McArdle, author of the recent Bloomberg View article, Air Travel is Worse Than a Hummer with Wings. The title alone will grab you. Where are we going with this? What's next? Is the airline industry going to be tasked with making changes? Are we going to have to find an emissions station to roll these things into and shove the little probe in the back to see what's coming out?
Well, you know, I think it's complicated because unlike cars, so with a car, it really is feasible to have an electric car. It may not be desirable. And many people will be saying, no, I don't want to have to plug my car in.
You know what? I live out in Anne Arundel County, right. Maryland, and I normally take the Mark Rail in and then Metro and such. And it only takes me a couple of minutes to get to the actual train station from mm-hmm. my house. But when I do drive in, I'm normally in that big SUV all by myself.
Yeah.
And I look around and I see all the other big SUVs. It's easier for us.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the irony is that an electric car would be perfect for someone like me, except for one thing, which is that I live in an old row house in the yeah. historic District of Columbia, and I have nowhere to plug it in. But, you know, these are things you can picture fixes for them. You can picture more electrics, more hybrids, smaller cars the way they do in Europe. Mm-hmm. What you can't picture is a way to make air travel vastly more efficient, because the energy density of hydrocarbons is such that we're pretty much only going to be able to get an airplane off the ground using either oil or some kind of synthetic oil that we've made that pretty much has the same properties, which means that getting rid of those carbon emissions is going to be really difficult. So I'm not sure that I see a big change on this front, because the government likes regulations that at least appear low cost, right? You do CAFE standards, maybe this raises the average price of a car, but that's pretty invisible. But you slap a big fuel tax on airlines and people are going to scream to Washington, and those screams will be heard.
Those Dreamliners are already having battery problems. Can you imagine the size of a battery it would take to get a plane off the ground?
Well, it would be so heavy that the plane actually wouldn't fly. Yeah, so yeah, they actually, really, I'm told that that will never happen.
Really long extension cords, maybe?
Yes, very much. Absolutely. Your mom's waving at you as you go overhead.
Wait, you forgot something. Pulling it back to the ground. This is exciting, and I look forward to hearing more about this. Megan, will you come back and talk to us again?
Absolutely. Anytime.
Very good. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
It is funny, though. I was looking, you know, you can buy a sofa, a chocolate chip cookies, and a snorkel set all in the same. The sofa didn't surprise me, but the snorkel set. Now, that was impressive. Although, I do want to ask, who's snorkeling right now? How many of those are you guys selling?
And with that, we put the wraps on this week's edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me on Twitter at Alan L. Scott. We'll catch you next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.